Hello and welcome. I'm here with Amit Joshi, and we're about to kick off a three-part series on tech in sports. Today, we're going to focus on tech and analytics in the professional game. In our next episode, we're going to look at the wild world of esports. And in the final episode, we'll look at consumer tech to help all of us become fitter and healthier. All right, let's start off by looking at analytics in professional sports. Amit, how did the use of analytics in sport start?
Hey, Mike. So super excited to bring these topics over the next three episodes to our listeners. It's something, you know, most of us love, sports. Sports has been collecting data for ages, right? But there's nothing really new about this. You know, there's always all kinds of data, whether it's baseball with ERAs or crickets with the averages. For those of you who are cricket fans, 99.94 Donald Bradman's average, which will probably never be beaten. Pele's record of 1,000 international goals in soccer. There's always been all kinds of data and analytics related to sport. But what really, really took this to the next level, I think, was the advent of the famous Moneyball. And this is something I know you are also super interested in discussing. But my understanding of this particular thing was that in baseball, right, you have incredible amount of data on discrete events. What do I mean by this? In baseball, you have one pitcher pitching or throwing the ball to a batter who's at the other end. And not only that, there is no other real physical factor in between that relationship. So the ground doesn't matter, the weather really doesn't matter, the condition of the ball doesn't matter, nothing matters. So there are psychological factors, obviously, you know, the status of the game and home field, away field, those kinds of things, whether it's playoffs, yeah. But physically, it is mano a mano. It's one person going up against another. As a consequence, you can collect incredible amount of discrete data on this. Say, okay, whenever Mike is pitching, how does Amit perform? What are the kinds of pitches he can face well? What are the kinds of pitches he struggles with? And baseball in a single season in the United States plays as many as 180 games. So just in one season, each game, of course, has 9 innings for each side. So each game has the potential to generate incredible amount of data. And that's really what kicked off this revolution, didn't it?
Yeah, sure. And I like the fact, I mean, I'm a big Michael Lewis fan. So he's the guy who wrote the book Moneyball. Of course, it was made into a movie, famously with Brad Pitt. And what I liked about that movie was that there's always been statistics in baseball, but nevertheless, a lot of the decisions were kind of made with intuition, right? The scouts would, you know, pick the next players and they'd look at the stats, of course, but they'd also, you know, look at the individuals themselves, they're cutting a powerful figure in the field, you know, the square jaw, intimidating pitchers, great physique, you know, the guys love him, leader in the dugout, this type of thing. And when you strip that away and you look at the data in a new visual, a new perspective, you can see that a lot of the traditional statistics were missing the point. So, you know, the statisticians that the Oakland A baseball team, which was not a big market team, you know, not a lot of money, you know, they started looking at the data differently and identifying players that were undervalued, sometimes significantly undervalued. And based on that, they'd pick up players that other teams didn't want for whatever reason and put together a team that significantly outperformed based on their, you know, their budget.
No, absolutely. And on that note, Mike, I'm reminded of the kind of intuition or gut feel that was typically used. There's this scene, there's this famous scene in Moneyball, for those of you who've seen it, where the scouts, you know, all these old, wizened, wise people are sitting around discussing. And one of them says, you know, no, this person, he's no good. Why? Because his girlfriend is not attractive enough. So he says, what has that got to do with anything? Well, it shows lack of confidence. You know, if you are a professional baseball player and you don't have an extremely attractive girlfriend, it means you're not confident and it's going to roll over. And I think, and whether or not that's valid, we don't know. However, I think what Moneyball did, what baseball managed to do is take a lot of these tacit understandings or take a lot of these implicit knowledge about the game and figure out a way to translate that into numbers. And I think that was the real contribution of this. And I think we know, well, most of us know how the story ends, right? I mean, Oakland A's, yeah, they benefited from Moneyball, but they didn't really win anything major at all, right? I mean, and to date, they've not won anything major. And that's been the big rap against Moneyball, which is that it works during regular season, but come the playoffs, come the real, you know, battles, it kind of seems to fall apart, right? Do you also see it that way, Mike?
Yeah, sure. There's something around the playoffs which is fundamentally different. So those statistics that work well in the regular season maybe don't work so well in the playoffs. And of course, the other thing is that the world doesn't exist in a vacuum, and the other teams see what they're doing and say, okay, well, guess what? We can do that too. So one of the things that they figured out was the importance of something called on-base percentage. You know, they're always looking at number of hits and this type of thing, and percentage of hits for at-bats. But on-base percentage was something that the Oakland A's paid particular attention to. Because it turns out in baseball, for those of you who are not baseball aficionados, I'm certainly not, you can get on base by, you know, not hitting, right? Just by, you know, taking enough balls, so bad pitches, and then you can get on base. So there were lots of players who weren't necessarily the biggest hitters or the fastest runners, but they were really good at seeing pitches. And so they could take enough balls and they can get on base. So on-base percentage was one of the statistics that they took particular attention to. They combined this with another statistic called slugging percentage. And from that, they saw the players in kind of a different perspective, and they could rank them differently. And I think that was an interesting way to rethink how analytics is done. And I guess we've seen that, you know, in other sports as well, haven't we?
Absolutely. But even before that, sticking to just baseball, right? While the Oakland A's themselves might not have killed it, the same technique was used by the Chicago Bears to win. And then the general manager of Chicago Bears went most famously to Boston, which had been suffering the famous curse of the Bambino, right? Which was for 100 years, they had not won anything. And of course, he led them to two or three, I think it was two back-to-back championships about a decade or so ago. But you're right. I mean, this has translated into other sports. And in other sports, Mike, not only has analytics changed the way the game is played, it has changed the way people experience the game. And the most obvious example of this is basketball, actually. Basketball very, very quickly adopted analytics right on the heels of baseball. And one of the cool things that the analysts or even the coaches in basketball, they discovered is that taking a shot, so most of our listeners will probably know this, in basketball you can score 2 points by hitting a basket from inside the arc, or if you step outside the arc, which is far away, you get 3 points. However, if you are just inside the arc, like a couple of feet inside the arc, you still get 2 points, and your probability of hitting a shot is almost exactly the same as if you took one step back, right? To be more specific, what they figured out is if you're right under the basket, the probability that you'll make a basket in something like the NBA, which is a top league, is in the region of 60%. If you're slightly away from the basket and you're taking what's known as the jump shot, you have about a 50% chance of converting and you get 2 points. If you're closer to the edge of the circle, but you're still inside the circle, you've got a 35% chance of making it, but you also have a 35% chance from outside the circle, in which case you get 3 points, which is 50% more than 2 points. So what happened is, over the last 10 years or so, coaches actually punish players for taking shots from inside the arc. They say, okay, unless you're right under the basket, okay, don't take shots because it makes no sense. The probability, like a 40% probability of a 2-point shot, is much worse than a 35% probability of a 3-point shot. So the average number of 3-point shots attempted in the NBA has gone from about 15 or 16 in a game to about 23 in a game, a 50% increase in about a 5 or 6 year period. And of course, if you're looking at one team, the one team in this case that has really led this is the Golden State Warriors and Steph Curry, whom a lot of you will ever hear about, who loves launching 3 points even from the half court line and actually sinking them. But this is where that philosophy is coming from. It's all coming from analytics. It's absolutely amazing.
So it's changed the game, right? And we're seeing these situations not very often. We do see them when a player gets a breakaway. And in the past, they would just go and, you know, dunk the ball and everybody would go crazy. And instead of doing that, they'll stop before the three-point line, launch a shot to get 3 points rather than 2 points. And then if they miss, they can go in and get the rebound. So it's very much changed the way the game is played. Also, you know, statistics are used around the life of players. So there's percentages of chances of players being successful, which is linked back to their home life, right? So players who grew up with fathers in the home and versus without fathers in the home, there is a statistical difference in how successful they're likely to be as players later in their lives. So there's all this statistics being used now to help predict teams, because, you know, picking a player is a very, very expensive proposition, right? And the cost of failure is extremely high. So using all these statistics to try and predict which players are going to succeed and which are not going to succeed is a big deal. But how can we see tangible results for this, you know, as spectators? You know, what does it mean for us as viewers?
I think it has changed the speeds at which sports are played. I think it has changed the absolute number of exciting moments that we see in a game. They've gone up significantly higher. And I think the biggest example of that is actually cricket. Now, cricket, some of us might know this. I love cricket. This is the first love of my life, like many of you might know by now. So the thing with cricket, and of course, everybody knows this as the boring old 200-year-old game that takes 5 days and you might not even get a result. However, you know, the game itself has sped up dramatically as a consequence of changes in the game, but as it changes in analytics. Let me give you just one example. So there's a shorter form of the game now called a T20, which happens over roughly 3 hours instead of 5 days, so which is closer in timeline to a baseball game. Each side plays 20 overs, which is about 120 pitches. And the biggest league for that is the Indian Premier League, which was started about, you know, 17 years ago. Now, there's a team in the Indian Premier League called the Kolkata Knight Riders. They're based in Kolkata, the big city in the east of India. The person who owns that team, a co-owner, is actually an alumnus of IMD. So I had met with him, and I had also met their CEO, a brilliant person by the name of Venki Mysore. And what Venki has basically done is he's taken some of these ideas of Moneyball and NBA and all the other sports and applied it to cricket. And KKR, they're a relatively small market team in terms of funds and stuff like that, comparable to the big ones in Mumbai and Delhi and stuff like that, or even Bangalore. However, they've already won the championship 2 times. They will probably win it this time again. They're one of the top contenders. They're doing really, really well this time. And how have they done it? They have done it very much in line with the Moneyball philosophy. So what they do is, they identify roles. Now, cricket is much more complicated than baseball. It's not a mano, one-to-one. The pitch matters, the weather matters, everything. The state of the ball matters in cricket. Everything matters, right? However, you still have different positions and you have different needs for different positions. So what one of the things KKR did very early on is they said, okay, at this particular place, we need a left-handed player with a strike rate of at least 150 who's good against this kind of bowling on those kinds of wickets. Now, once they narrow down the profile, they look at the people who are available on the market and just take the best from that rather than just going for the best player, which is always going to be super expensive. So what they've done brilliantly is beautifully balance the budget that they have to spend on these with the roles that those people have in the team. And using that, they've basically built an incredible team that doesn't really have a single superstar. They've got literally 11 players who are role players who are brilliant at what they do, but no single person would be by themselves considered a superstar, unlike the other team. And they're doing incredibly well. And what this has done to the game is it's become so much faster in cricket. You're seeing many more sixes or what the home run in baseball is being hit. More runs are getting scored. How bowling happens is changing. You're seeing this across the board, absolutely.
Well, that sounds to me like it's going to be more exciting. If it's faster and there's more points being scored and more sixes being scored, that sounds like it's a good thing, isn't it?
incredibly good thing, and it's drawing in completely new audiences, right? So, I mean, so what started off as a field innovation is now moving into the consumer space. My daughter, who's American, who's born in America and then raised in Switzerland, she loves IPL. She can tell you the names of the players and the teams and their and how much they've scored. Why? Because it's so exciting for these kids now, right? I mean, they discuss it in her school in Switzerland with other kids. It has completely changed how we view the sport.
Okay, let's switch gears and talk about another sport where technology has had a very big impact, but not universally positive. And that's the world of professional football. I'm talking about soccer football, the real football, not the American football. And VAR. So any of our listeners who follow football know exactly what this video assistant referee. This is technology to help support referees make decisions on the field using cameras to check for offsides, check if goals are really scored, to check red card offenses and so forth, handballs and all that. And this has been introduced into many of the professional leagues for the last few years, and it has become incredibly controversial. Despite the fact that, you know, the data suggests that mistakes have gone down. With referees, mistakes are around 14%. 14% of the time, the referee will screw up. With VAR, it's 2 to 3% of the time it'll screw up. But nevertheless, there's a lot of controversy.
Why? Today. Why is that the case? Why is there a controversy? What's the deal?
I think there's a few reasons why there's controversy. I think one of the reasons is that there are actually still humans in the loop. It's not like the VAR makes the decision. The VAR shows data, and then there's humans actually making the decision behind that, and you would expect them to get it right because they have all the data. But they also make mistakes. So I think that's part of it, you know, the teams getting frustrated. The other thing is that it slows the game down. Right? Before, you'd have a decision, and that's the decision, right? And the players would complain, but basically the referee, you know, almost never changed his or her mind. And now every time there's a goal, there's this kind of long wait. So, you know, the players and the fans can't really get too excited and celebrate what's happening because they're waiting for the VAR decision. So it slows the game down. It kind of takes a little bit of the excitement away. And I think it, you know, inserts a lot of doubt in the game. So for that reason, you know, I mean, right this week, as we're talking, the teams have decided that they're going to vote on whether to remove VAR from the Premier League in the UK. I don't think it'll pass.
See, that's fascinating, right? Especially the second thing about slowing it down. I think, and my limited understanding of VAR is that it's a black box system, right? The referee goes to the screen and he or she comes out with a decision or a changed decision, and the fans have no participation in that. Contrast that to what cricket has put in place. Cricket also has a system, it's called DRS, wherein you can appeal. The teams can get a limited number. You can appeal the decision of the umpire. Now, in this particular case, everything is shown live on the screens, including in the stadium. So the entire audience is participating in what's happening. You know, as the replays and slow-mo are coming up, there's a roar going up if it's out or not out, if the decision is getting overturned. And it's all black and white saying, okay, look, the umpire said it's out, but this happened and that happened. Because of this reason, it is decided as not out. And it's almost as if all of us are making the decision together. And it's actually become a cool feature. It does slow it down, I agree, but it's become a cool participative feature of the game, actually.
Right. And you can take that to the extreme, right? And actually have the audience participate. Now, we don't see this very often, but there are some examples like Formula E, which is the kind of motor racing, you know, the electric version of Formula One, which, of course, is sort of digital by default because they're using electric powertrains. They actually have experimented with allowing the fans who are watching to influence the outcome by voting on who can get a little bit of a power boost during a race. And of course, what they do is they typically give it to the one who's in second place, right? To try and overtake, you know, in the last corner, that type of thing. So you could actually have technology to have audience participation in sports. Now, we don't see that very often, right? In most professional sports, that doesn't exist. But even that it's being experimented with is kind of interesting and exciting, you know, for the future.
That is really, really cool. Really cool. And we are going to talk a little bit more about some of the, it's not e-racing, but we're going to talk about e-sports in our very next episode, aren't we, Mike?
We sure are. So let's close this episode down. There is a ton of tech in sports today, and it's probably only going to increase. How do you see the future?
I agree with you, right? I mean, sensors everywhere, shirts, shoes, everything has sensors, equipment, tennis rackets, cricket bats now have sensors not in the game but outside. It's going to impact the game. It's going to impact how players are selected and chosen. It's going to impact how we train, right? It's going to impact every aspect of this. So I'm super excited about the future of this. It's going to make the game more fair, more accessible. You know, all the positives that we hope digital will deliver in other aspects, we are seeing a lot of them happening in sports.
All right, so that's the world of tech in professional sports. In the next episode, we'll talk about esports. But for now, thanks for tuning in. And if you want more information on programs that we're offering at IMD, go to imd.org. See you next time.